In today's Spotlight, we feature Hilda Besson-Namanjebo, a native of Windhoek, who serves as the Managing Director of Oxygen Communications, a leading strategic communications firm specialising in brand development, advertising, media strategy and strategic public relations. Hilda is a prolific writer and hosts panel discussions on topical issues after years of service in both the public and private media. Hilda is a serial entrepreneur, investing in numerous businesses. She is also the founder of the national brand called Team Namibia. Can you take us through your childhood and where you grew up?
I'm the original Katatura girl, just from here, from Windhoek. So born and bred really in Windhoek. I grew up in Katatura, the dusty streets of Katatura, specific area, federal location. Mm-hmm. But I grew up in a mixed environment. My mother was a South African woman who found a way in Namibia, or found a way to Namibia after marrying Namibian many years before the country was even called Namibia. Mm-hmm. And because she was not Namibian, we grew up very mixed with everybody, you know, as our friends in the country. Yeah, just in our community. Mm-hmm. So we also were exposed to a number of cultures, yes, languages, etc., traditions. Yeah, so people always struggle to find out what tribe you are because Namibians like those things. But hey, I always tell people I'm tribeless.
Yeah.
I'm a Namibian.
Yeah. Now, what were some of the challenges you faced during your early years?
I think, you know, for me, I think exactly just what I highlighted, growing up as a child in a community that really sought to define people according to their culture. Mm. I remember that was something because I always never knew where I fit in.
Years.
Yeah, because you don't fit in here, you don't fit in there, because you're not enough of that, and you're too much of that. Mm-hmm. So my story of my life really is that I've always, whether it was in the boardroom, you're too much of this and not enough of that, whether it is, you know, in some spaces that you occupy, you're constantly having to prove yourself that mm-hmm. you are enough. Mm-hmm. And then when you regard it as too much, then you must tone yourself down and say, okay, fine, can I tone myself down?
Yeah.
And I remember that as some of my growing up challenges. Eventually, you know, growing when you're an adult, you realize this is who I am.
Yeah.
This is who I'm packaged. This is how I'm packaged. And this is the way in which the world must just experience me.
Yeah.
Because this is who I am.
Yeah. And then who were your biggest influences or role models?
To this day, my dad probably, you know, and my mom, you know, in a different way. My parents were very strong leaders. Mm. And though my father died when I was very little, I have very vibrant memories of him and of his leadership qualities and the spaces in which he occupied. And remember, this was in pre-independence Namibia.
Yeah.
So whether it was serving on a school board, you know, or writing for Hosea Kutako, which he did at stages. So the writing thing has always been a thing in our family. The gift of speaking has always been a thing in our family, and we mm-hmm. really get it from him. So, and my mom died about 3 years ago, and I think then we were able to discover her, and, you know, almost like after her passing, you discover who the person really was. Mm-hmm. Because women kind of, from that generation, didn't stand out like the men stand out. I mean, it's still a challenge now. But it was more so during my mom's time.
Yeah.
And it was after she died that we really discovered, you know, who she really was. We looked through the archives she kept, for example, on family history. We looked at the books. You know, my father wasn't, you know, a prolific writer. She would keep some of his writings. She was a writer of some sort because I had exposure to it because often I would be called in to come and write a speech. Or write something that she had to deliver at a church event or something like that. She was very involved with church.
My parents. So the apple didn't fall far from the tree.
No, it doesn't look like it. Yeah, no. Yeah, the apple certainly didn't fall very far from the tree. Yeah. So that's really who I consider my role models to be. I learn from everybody. I learn from everybody. Mm. I learn from everybody. So I don't really hold people entitled, you know, particularly in a higher esteem to the manner in which I hold people who are not entitled of that high level, you know, because I believe you learn from everything. It depends on your attitude and how you approach people and whether you can be taught. Are you really teachable? Mm-hmm. And I believe I'm teachable, and I really am intentional about being teachable.
So then what was your educational journey like? Did you have a particular passion you pursued?
I think language was always the thing. Mm. So I was, but so in school, we had the exposure to social science or pure sciences. So I went the social science. When I could select, I went the social part, social science component. So I did history and I did geography. I mean, so, and language, strong language. So I had three languages at school. So when I left school, I thought I would become a translator because, you know, you looked at the options which were available to you during that time. So
what were these languages?
German. So I had Afrikaans, English and German. Mm-hmm. So German was then the language in which I wanted to really forge a career path.
Yeah.
You know, I wanted to forge a career path in that. And yeah, I did very well. I got an A in German in my grade 12 year. Mm-hmm. Yeah. And I thought I'd go and live in Germany, actually. That was kind of like the plan. And then really just do linguistics, you mm-hmm. know, because I thought that would be my area of expertise.
Mm-hmm.
Media was always interesting to me, but it didn't look like an obvious career. The media thing manifested later, let me put it that way.
Mm.
Interestingly enough, I would always, you know, under my mom had a fig tree, for example, at home, and I would always under that fig tree roll up a bunch of newspapers and direct it to my mouth and then speak into this microphone. That was my memory of a little girl. That I remember very clearly. I remember other incidents, you know, obviously Kartura was rife with political engagement and rallies and stuff like that. Mm. So we grew up in a very politicized environment.
Yeah.
You know, rallies everywhere. You knew the stories of Shifidi, for example, the day on which he was killed. You knew that something like that had happened in Kartura, a big, you know, thing like that happened. So politically, I was very exposed. I think it's a combo of all of these happenings around my community and in my home. My father, again, was, like I told you, was an avid reader. And so he would bring the newspaper home every day and we would have to read that newspaper mm-hmm. every day. So, and radio was on all the time. So I listened to radio the entire time. My dad also, he was definitely way ahead of his time.
Yeah.
Because he would know about events taking place in other parts of the world, like boxing matches, like rugby, you know, being played somewhere else, football, big football matches being played. And we would, in the middle of the night, he would actually listen to it on radio because of the time difference.
Yeah.
So I was exposed to stuff like that, which normally couldn't happen in a home. Obviously, then television came a few years later. He wasn't available around then. And so television just became the next thing, which obviously consumed me.
Mm.
So I think it was such a combination of such a variety of things which made me go into the fields in which I eventually went into, you know. And then obviously he was at NBC for a number of years. And was then able to, NBC at that time still had exchange programs with German institutions. And I was able to go and study through a bursary that I had through NBC
mm-hmm.
and television production and engineering. And then eventually I studied public relations when I was back in the country. And I've been studying for quite a number of years, but I just keep studying. Now my fascination is obviously oil and gas. In fact, right now, I mean, I was actually doing an oil and gas training yesterday and today. And I've done quite a few. I did hydrogen last year as well, so I can understand the basics of hydrogen and what the new energy source will mean for us. It's just, something that I do all the time.
Yeah.
I just study all the time, whether it is, you know, whether it's governance, whether it's AI, which is a great fascination at the moment. I love the field of AI. So I really learn all the time. Last year, I did public policy and analysis for the University of London. The School of Economics, public policy analysis, because I wanted to understand why we say in Namibia we have such great policies, but we don't see the implementation thereof,
mm-hmm.
and we don't see it particularly being effective. What is it that we're not doing and missing?
Yeah.
So
what are we doing
right? I probably will do a bunch of other things before I eventually call it a day on the side of the earth. Yeah.
And then taking you back to your first job, what was your first job and how did it influence your career trajectory?
So my first job was, I was actually, and very few people know this, maybe this is the
presenting,
first time.
Presenting.
Because people think I started at NBC. No, I didn't start at NBC.
Mm-hmm.
I started at Home Affairs.
Oh, and wow.
I did not know that. Yes. No, you're not the only one. So at Home Affairs, what they had a liaison officer.
Mm-hmm.
I don't even know if they really called it Maggie, a liaison officer. And what it meant, it was just you were in charge. You were not in charge. You were responsible for internal communications.
Mm-hmm.
Because the country is as wide and big and broad as it is. Somebody would apply for an ID in Katima Mulilo, mm-hmm. but then couldn't travel to Windhoek to know how. And obviously, we didn't have tracking systems then that you would know. I applied for my ID on the 1st of December,
yeah.
and now it's in the system at that stage, and it will eventually get to me the next year on the 1st of September. But you had a human being facilitating that, you know, that contact. So the person would go to Katima, apply there, and then he would go and check in at Katima, and Katima would call Windhoek, which is where I was,
mm-hmm.
you know, and ask me how far is this person's ID. So I was a liaison officer mm-hmm. between all of the Home Affairs officers in the country.
Mm-hmm.
And that's eventually then the NBC came out of that experience. So clearly the PR thing was always there, mm-hmm. understanding stakeholder audiences yeah. was always there.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, so it's interesting how life brings it all together.
Yeah. So then what were some key milestones in your career that significantly contributed to your success?
Look, I think landing my job at NBC at the time, well, it was NBC was just fantastic. I mean, I actually would have worked for NBC without a salary. That's how much I loved my job at NBC. The salary was like an extra benefit.
Yeah.
But I so loved the exposure. I loved the research. I loved the networks that it presented to me, of course. And the fields, you know, the fields of knowledge that you gain mm-hmm. as a consequence of engaging different people. I think I did Gwen Lister's first interview after independence, because obviously she was a banned personality,
yeah.
and nobody spoke. The government entity certainly didn't speak to her and gave her a platform for engagement. And so Gwen was one of the people that I interviewed quite early after independence.
Yeah, that's huge.
Joan Guriraz is another one, you know, this fantastically, incredibly beautiful woman.
Yeah.
Still one of the most beautiful women I've ever seen, who I'm now privileged to call my mother, because she adopted me and I adopted her. Because we were both adult enough to like each other enough and say, I like you and I like you. Yeah. So I interviewed her, you know, soon after coming, you know, back from, you know, obviously after independence, having married Hugh Ben-Gurirab. I interviewed him numerous times. Sam Nyoma, wow, always, always, always upstanding. He stands just so tall above all experiences and most experiences I've had in my life. Somehow he liked me. At NBC, and I would always get a little bit of, I know I got special attention from him, you know, it could be because of my work ethic, and I think he's a person who has his own particular work ethic, and I think maybe that was what he saw in me. So, you know, I know I had the opportunity to interview him quite a few times. Michael Jackson came. I had the privilege to host him, look after him, came a few times. I had the opportunity to look after quite a number of people. I've done big conferences. I've met presidents, really numerous presidents, too many to mention, especially during President Pohamba's time, President Nyoma handing over to President Pohamba.
Yeah.
That exposure. Thabo Mbeki, that was a tough one. Thabo Mbeki is a difficult human being. I still fear the guy. He was not an easy guy to interview. He's not an easy guy to even have a conversation with. He's highly intellectual. He's highly, highly intellectual, but extremely moody, in my view. So he was, and it was at this. We had the smart partnership dialogues at the time. So he was, wow. He was just, yeah. He was a significant leader during that space. So politically, I've had huge exposure to local and international leaders. Public relations, I'm a thinker, so I like to understand things. I don't do things just willy-nilly. I need to think something through. I need to understand something before I embark upon a strategy. I had early also exposure then, you know, during my time at NAMPOS, to what the full scope of communications, the communications would mean. How do you run a communications department? Because I do believe, I may be wrong though, but I do think that I was the first Black woman appointed to senior executive position in the parastatal spaces. There was one woman in the private sector, Gita Sikande, and she became my mentor and she coached me through
landing a really amazing job after NBC at Lamppost as an executive in days when there were no black women in those rooms. Mm. And it was just strange and we didn't know how to behave. And I didn't know whether I should pour the tea when the tea came around because I didn't quite know how to take up space in that environment. Mm. And after a few months, you know, of coaching with her and learning and reading, traveling to South Africa, meeting other black women, hey, how do we maneuver this? How do we navigate this opportunity that we have now? You know, it became easier. And that's why that remains a passion of mine to this day, that we need to, provide opportunities for other women and help them navigate these spaces.
Yeah. And then having said that, you know, how did you navigate the challenges and the pressures of advancing in your field?
I think humility helped. I know who I am. And I know just because I don't know doesn't make me a lesser human being. It doesn't make, I know I'm smart. One of the things I really love, and I'm unashamed to say this, I know I'm a smart woman.
No, you are smart.
And because I think I can, and I think because anybody can learn. It's obviously there's talent and there's things like genetics, which make you have an affinity for this more than that. Mm-hmm. But any and everybody can learn and everybody can become a master in their field.
Yeah.
And so I've decided I'm going to master the fields that I have been talented, that I've been gifted to master, you know. And once I've mastered that space, it gives me authority in that space.
Yeah,
and as a consequence, I then demand respect, you know, on the basis of that.
Absolutely.
But if you don't grant me respect, it also doesn't make me fall apart because I know who I am.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I don't fall apart because of people's vantage points or the impressions that they have on me.
Exactly. I love that.
Yeah.
Now, can you share any example of a difficult decision that you had to make as a leader?
You know, this is such an interesting one. When you sent me the question, I was like thinking, what are we going to say about this? Because so I think leadership in its continuum is difficult. It requires a focus. It requires conviction. I think the conviction component is the one that's probably the most challenging, that you don't sell out values. Mm. So difficult decisions have meant that I walk away from deals that I don't feel they meet the standard that I need.
Mm-hmm.
And that would mean a moral standard.
Mm-hmm.
Difficult decisions would mean that sometimes, that's been most of it. You know, really, if I think about it, I honestly cannot sell my soul. I find it extremely difficult to sit in meetings and to sit in rooms where I know that there are compromises here.
Mm.
And ethically, I could not, and morally, I couldn't justify being here.
Mm.
And sometimes, you know, the opportunities look amazing. And then you think, but I can must just sell out for now.
Mm.
But you know that in the long run, you wouldn't make it. I don't last long in those environments.
Mm. Kind of like
so
know
I
your worth.
Know your worth, know your value system, and let that be what navigates you.
Mm-hmm.
You know, a moral compass of sorts. And it meant that, you know, I've lost money. Because I've lost deals because I wasn't prepared to close my eyes to view things that would happen in those rooms.
Mm-hmm.
So difficult decisions have been like that, you know, just walking away, just absolutely deciding to walk away because I know that I have a future and I know that, you know, I know that God is not poor. And if he provides for me one day, he will continue to provide for me for that foreseeable future.
You know,
he doesn't run out of money or opportunity.
Yeah. Yeah. What qualities do you believe are essential for effective leadership?
So I'm a servant leader. So I sorted that out as well, because there are different models of leadership. I had the opportunity to, with John Maxwell, who is probably one of the greatest leaders in the world today. I did 3 years of training with John Maxwell. John Maxwell, in his early days, way before he became as widely popular as he is, selected 1 million leaders around the world. I was one of those 1 million leaders.
Shoot.
And for 3 years, we went on training with John Maxwell on leadership.
Wow.
And he trained us on servant leadership and effective leadership and all of these books which are available and around the world right now on John Maxwell. He trained us that material. What it meant is that you then had to, because you were privileged to be in that position, he called it Equip. And he called it, his program was run, and it ran under the name of Million Leaders Mandate. That's how the 1 million leaders were selected around the world.
Mm-hmm.
And in turn, you'd have to go and train another 25 so that you can kind of pay it forward. That was the model of leadership that he deployed.
Mm-hmm.
So I've trained thousands, hundreds of leaders on John Maxwell material. I still continue to do so to this day. I've trained hundreds of leaders. I'm in fact going to train again today because I now am a trainer with the African Leadership Institute at Rock Lodge, mm-hmm. where we train teachers, principals, executives in business, in corporate, private sector, public sector as well. So I'm a servant leader. I understand that. I truly understand the principle that when Jesus said that if you want to be the greatest of all, you must be the servant of all. I understand Martin Luther King, who says that even if you are a sweeper, if you sweep the streets, be the best sweeper that you can be. Exactly. Because it's not through title that you achieve mm-hmm. greatness. It is through service that you achieve greatness.
Mm-hmm.
So I serve people. If I go into a space, I look for an opportunity to serve because it's not about me. And if I serve well, then I create, legacy. I'm also fixated with legacy. I want to leave a legacy for my children.
Mm.
I want to leave a legacy for the Namibian girl child who have an opportunity to be amazing in some of these spaces. Therefore, I take myself very seriously in those spaces because I don't just represent myself.
Mm-hmm.
I represent all of us. Because Maggie, if a woman messes up, it's not Gilda who messed up. It's women are like that.
Exactly.
And that's a fact. And whether I like it or not, it's a fact.
Yeah.
So I have a responsibility to make sure that for women who come after me, that they have it easier than what I had it.
Mm-hmm.
Because it's tough having to be second guessed all the time. Mm-hmm. Are you really as competent as you pretend to be?
Yeah.
You know? I know I have a responsibility on my shoulders, just like the women who went before me also had a responsibility on their shoulders and gave us an Namibia that would be easier for us, you know, to manage and maneuver. I have the same responsibility to the next generation of women.
Mm-hmm.
So I'm a generational leader. I'm a servant leader. I'm not a title leader. That freaks out people because people don't know how to define me. People are like, what are you really? What do you really do? You know, I say, I don't know. I introduced myself to a lady the other day and she was like, what do you really do? I was like, yeah, you know, it's kind of hard to tell you what I do because I do quite a lot of things because I don't have a title. You know,
yeah.
I do many different things because I want to serve in as many opportunities as I have available.
Yeah, exactly. Now, how do you maintain a balance between your professional and personal life?
I balance it because I understand why I was born. I have a very strong sense of my purpose. I know what my accountabilities will be. Mm-hmm. I know what my accountabilities are right now. And so I don't separate my life in this is a professional column and this is a personal column. Look, I have the wonderful opportunity to be an entrepreneur. That gives me certain freedoms about my time and the manner in which I apply my time.
Mm.
Like I always say to people, if I want to bake at 10 o'clock in the morning, I bake at 10 o'clock in the morning because I love baking. If I work until 12 o'clock tonight because I baked at 10 o'clock in the morning, I can work at 12 o'clock in the evening, you know, because fortunately my family allows me to do that because they understand who I am and they allow me to flourish and to fulfill the purpose that they believe that God has established and created me for.
Yeah.
So I don't have, this is personal. This is professional. It is one life. I live one life and that life has expressions.
Yeah.
You know, and sometimes the expression is a professional expression. Sometimes it's just individual expression, you know, but I see it like this. But I also am very jealous of my private time. I'm very particular about spending time on my own. I make sure I create time in my schedule to be on my own because I love being on my own and I love to read. I love to research. I love to renew myself and stuff like that. I love to go for walks. I love to climb mountains and trees and things like that that I can to the extent that I can. So that's probably how I relax. But it's on my own terms. I try and do love life as much on my own terms. Obviously, understanding that I have certain accountabilities, mm-hmm. but I don't allow society to tell me who I should be, how I should be, and how I should operate. Yeah,
exactly. And then in conclusion, what advice would you give to young individuals aspiring to achieve similar success?
Like, begin with the end in mind. Stephen Covey has a book like that.
Mm.
And that's one of his principles. Begin with the end in mind. Write the eulogy. Write your eulogy first and decide, how do I live to attain that eulogy? What do I want them to say? You know, what would it's not even so much, it's not even so much that I want people to say nice things about me at my funeral. It's what will my legacy be by the time that I'm no more? Mm-hmm. So work it backwards from that. So now that you know, this is what I want them to say, or this is what I would like to have on my gravestone.
Mm-hmm. Or be remembered for. Now,
or be remembered for. Now let's work it backwards. Mm-hmm. Let's work it backwards. So the decision that you make in this moment, how does it add up to that which will be written on your grave? Mm-hmm. You know, what will your reputation be at the end of the day?
Mm-hmm.
What will your legacy be? I'm fixated with legacy.
Mm-hmm.
I don't want to burden my children with a reputation, and I'm not perfect. Nobody is.
Mm-hmm.
But I certainly try to the extent that I can not to belabor my children with a legacy that they would have to defend, exonerate, have excuse for, feel embarrassed by, etc.
Yeah.
They must literally come and step on the legacy that I've established, and they must use it as a launching pad and fly.